All right, dear friends, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and just grab my water here and washing down some Doritos Cool Ranch tortilla chips. Any port in a storm. I'm not a big fan of Doritos. They're not bad, but they're not good for you either. But I do like corn chips. I'm a Tostitos fan. You know, the crispy rounds. They what? They're saying, please get on with the show, Greg. I'm just saying, okay? You put a crispy round on your tongue, and it's an explosion of salty flavor. It's fabulous. Really, I love it. Piece of cheese as a chaser. Anyway, like I said, Doritos, Cool Ranch, any port in a storm, right? I just needed something to hold me over between segments. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, 855-243-9975 is the number if you'd like to call in, and you can do that during our live radio show times, and that is on Tuesday nights, evenings, if you will, depending on where you're at, I guess. But it's for us, it's Tuesday evening, 4 to 6 p.m. Glad to take your calls. You give me a piece of your mind, I will give you a piece of my mind as well. 855-243-9975. Really excited about Rethink coming up in Dallas, March 2nd to 3rd. We know it's going to be a great Rethink because all of them are. We've had, I think, pretty close to 9 or 10 Rethinks. Yeah, I'd say maybe even more than that. But they've been, we've had Orange County for 6 years. Then we had two Dallases. Then we've had one Birmingham. We got another Dallas coming up. And we got another Birmingham coming up. March 2nd and 3rd, Cottonwood Creek Church in Dallas. And that's coming up real quickly, 4 weeks. We got 747 people signed up in advance, 4 weeks ahead. Are you kidding me? That's unbelievable. People are jazzed. They're excited. They're looking forward to a grand time with a great lineup of speakers. It's the best thing you could do for your kid to educate him how to defend his faith right now. I'm just telling you. And it's fun. We're going to have a lot of fun, but it's going to be good stuff, too. We don't dumb anything down. We throw the ball so you can catch it, and we have a good time when we do it. April 20th to 21st, Briarwood Prez, Birmingham. All right? You can get all the skinny by simply going online to RethinkApologetics.com. Did I get that right? RethinkApologetics.com. All right? Now, I was asked a question the other day. I've been a Christian 44 years. So I was at an event, had the very fine hosts take me to lunch at a very fine restaurant, my favorite, Houston's. That made my day. It was not only a fine restaurant, but it was after work. We were done. It was Sunday afternoon, and we'd finished it. And, you want to go to a really nice place like that after you're all done working. And I was relaxing, enjoying myself. But in part of our conversation, he asked me something I don't think I've ever been asked this question before. He asked me, after 44 years of being a Christian, I became a Christian when I was 23 at UCLA, 44 years of being a Christian, how would you characterize it now as you look back and where you're at now? To be honest, I don't remember exactly how he worded the question, but it was like taking stock. And how would you assess things at the point you're at right now? How have things developed as you have grown in Christ? What would you say? And I thought about it. Actually, I didn't have to think long because, pardon me, there were two things that popped immediately into my mind. And I'm just offering these things to you by way of transparency as a brother in Christ, giving you a little bit of a idea of what's going on in my own mind on these things. Maybe in a way to influence your own expectations or possibly be an encouragement to you as you look at your own life. But I'm going to say something now that may surprise you. Hold on just a minute. I had to cough. It's that Doritos Cool Ranch dust in my throat right now. Hold on. I got to wash that down. I know this is really bad manners. Okay, thank you for putting up with me there. Here's what I said. After 44 years, one thing I've noticed is that things have gotten harder. That is, the older I get in the Lord, the more difficult life has become. Now, I suspect some of you hearing that, it strikes you a bit odd because it's counterintuitive. Some of you are breathing a sigh of relief, and you're thinking, wow, that's the same way it's been for me too. Maybe I'm not so weird. Well, maybe we're both weird. I don't know. But the fact is, that's the way it's been for me. And some who think it's an odd thing to say is, might think that because the church has a habit of being a little bit overly triumphal. And what I mean by that is, I think Christians are characteristically, when they reflect what's going on with them and the Lord, it's all hunky-dory. It's all so great and God's so wonderful. Now, I do think God's wonderful, but he's not wonderful because my life is wonderful. He's wonderful because he's wonderful. You know, life isn't always so easy, and don't you know it? You just maybe don't admit it so much to the rest of your friends. I am actually convinced that life is a series of incidents in which we solve problems. Most of the time, we are solving problems. And we solve one problem, and by golly, it's always something. There's another problem that pops up. And then we have to give ourselves to solving that, and there's another one. Blast it. Don't these problems ever stop coming? And I'm just going to say, no, they don't. Especially if you're a Christian. Look it, you are living in a foreign land. I was just humming to myself this little song, this little ditty that I learned a long time ago as a young Christian. It's kind of a corny old campfire type song. This world's not my home, I'm just a passing through. If heaven's not my home, oh Lord, what would I do? Now, why was I singing that? Because that's what I was thinking. If heaven's not my home, what am I going to do? Because this world is not my home. I like lots of things about this earth. I don't want to die. I got too many fun things that I'm looking forward to doing. Remodeling my house, working on my cabin, going fishing, working in my shop. Those are just recreational things. And a whole bunch of things that have to do with the kingdom that I still want to address to leave a better legacy behind. No, I don't want to go anywhere. I am enjoying it. I'm an optimist, generally speaking, but I'm just saying, in this world, you have tribulation. And if you're a Christian, you're living in a world that is not your home, it's going to be harder. Anyone who desires to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. That's Paul in 1 Timothy, I think. Just as Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves for the same purpose. That's Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2. And then in chapter 4, he says, why are you so amazed at this fiery ordeal among you, as if something strange were happening to you? It's not strange. It's ordinary. So the scriptures are testifying to the fact that our lives are going to be troublesome, are going to be fraught with challenge, fraught with difficulty. So if we're adults, if we're grown-ups, we accept that. Part of growing up is accepting the fact that being an adult means solving problems, and if you're a follower of Jesus, you're going to have more problems to solve. Now you've got more resources, too. That is, you have a sense of how the world is meant to be. You have guidance from God himself through his word. And so you can make the hard decisions that are the right decisions in the hard times. Now, by the way, it's not always easy to do that, to figure out what the right decision is, but you've got help, is what I'm saying. And growing in the Lord is growing in wisdom and capability of solving these kinds of problems that God puts allows in our path as a test. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you be perfect and complete and lacking in nothing. That's how the book of James opens, with that full-throated acknowledgement of the hardship and difficulty that we are going to experience as Christians. So, look, I don't like it any more than you do in a certain sense, but I want to be a grown-up about it. I want to think, okay, I'm going to step up, I'm going to man up, and even if you're a lady, I'm just going to say, will you still man up? That's just the way the language works. To lady up, it doesn't have the same punch, right? It doesn't work. You get my point. You stand up, you adult up, if you will. You grow up, if you will, and when we're training our children, we are trying to train them to grow up, to embrace the challenges that they face and to solve the problems and give them the tools to do that. My daughter, my 10-year-old, Eva, I don't know what we were talking about. It was something about, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do this. I want to have my free time. I said, honey, you will never have more free time, more latitude in your life than you have right now. It only gets harder. You have more problems to solve. And when you get really good at solving those small problems, guess what? You get bigger ones. The problems don't go away. You just get bigger problems, right? So that was the first thing I observed, and that is it's every year it's gotten harder. Here's the second thing I observed. Every year God has gotten quieter. Every year, God has gotten quieter. Now, I don't know entirely what to make of that. I'm just reporting to you. But I'm not the first person who said this kind of thing. I have been aware of other Christians who made a notable impact for Christ, who also testified that it seems like, in their experience, God got quieter. And I have a suspicion, though I can't recall something particular that Lewis said about this, I have a suspicion he had the same attitude. And the reason I say this is because of the way he has written in the character of Aslan in the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, Aslan doesn't show up very often in the Chronicles. In fact, that's a little bit of a problem, right? And there is talk, like in the first, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when they first stumble upon Narnia, they have been in the grip of the witch's control and always winter and never Christmas for a long, long time. But now Aslan is moving. Aslan is afoot. Finally, after all this time, in fact, he's been, in a sense, out of touch for so long that many of the players don't even believe in him anymore. And this comes up in other episodes, like The Voyage of the Dawn, Prince Caspian, and others, where you just see that, where is Aslan? Well, he doesn't show up very often. He shows up when necessary, but not. He's always in the background. You know, he's kind of always been there. Think of the story, The Horse and the Boy. I mean, this is an excellent example of that, where he actually shows himself at different times that people don't realize it. It's the end of the story when you see the narrator who lets you know where Aslan has been making his presence known. But from the perspective of the agents in the story, the people experiencing the drama, it seemed like he wasn't there. He was quiet. And this is just the way it seems to me. I think there were more things, the more dramatic things that happened in my life as a Christian, like, wow, did you see what God did there? More of those things happened when I was a younger Christian than what seemed to be happening to me as an older Christian. Now, this could very well be my own fault and my own shortcoming. I don't know. I don't know how to assess that, to be honest. But I've heard enough from others to find out that this doesn't strike me as an unusual thing. And Lewis says in Screwtape Letters, speaking now through Wormwood, that he leaves the creature to stand what seems to be on his own, okay? He removes his hand, if not in fact, at least from a conscious perspective, so that the creature stands on his own. So Lewis is saying, now the creature is language that Wormwood, the demon, is using to describe human beings. But you see Lewis's point. Lewis is saying, you know, early on there's this honeymoon. And then it's time to grow up. And so it seems like God pulls back, even though he's still there. So even Lewis is acknowledging this, not just in the style of narrative in the Chronicles, but it's explicitly here, now as I recall, in the Screwtape Letters. And he speaks to this. He calls it the law of angulation, that humans are creatures with one foot in eternity and the other foot in time, and the best they can do, given that reality, is just undulate, go up and down and up and down and up and down. And God trains us through that process, and that's the teaching of Lewis there. But anyway, so I've learned those two things stand out for me. Things get harder. Solving problems, always solving problems. Except for the problems get bigger. The challenges get bigger, which force us back into the arms of God in a certain sense. It throws us back to the throne of grace. It throws us down on our knees. We are pleading with God for help in time of trouble. We are humbling ourselves under the mighty hand of God. We are seeking to be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, making our requests known to God. I mean, these are all passages in Scripture you recognize and that we are instructed by. However, I just have to say, it isn't as if, wow, when I do all these things, all of a sudden, you know, the heavens come down and I'm dazzled with the presence of God and glory and all that. It just doesn't work that way, at least not for me. Some of you maybe have a different experience, but I suspect more of you are like me than not. Because I think this is what happens, even as Lewis pointed out, that God withdraws, if not in fact, at least from our conscious awareness, his presence, so that we are learn, in his words, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. Did you catch that? Lewis said, we learn to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It ain't fun anymore. Right. Now it's time to get down to learning to live and grow up. So there's just a thought for you, and I hope it's an encouragement, at least to some. It helps me. It honestly does. To just stand tall and persevere and want to be found by him with my hand on the plow, not looking back, bearing my cross, if you will, and I don't say that in a maudlin, poor me way. In fact, quite the opposite. I say these things to encourage you to, as I said earlier, to man up, to step up, to adult up, and accept what God has given us and be faithful. And the thing, the last question that was asked me in this regard was, how is it that I, what gives me comfort, given the fact that the problems get bigger and God seems to get quieter? And I'll just tell you what I said, and you can do with it what you want. But what gives me comfort would be my paraphrase of 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16 through 18. My paraphrase is just another 20 to 30 more years and it'll be done. That's all. Just another 20 or 30 more years. Oh, I know that sounds so depressing, but okay, I just want to hang on. I want to stay in there. Now, what verse was I referring to? Here's the one. And many of you know this passage, partly I know it because I've said it so much to myself, and it's in a certain sense a kind of a favorite. It's something that I instruct myself with many times, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. In fact, it's one that I read to Melinda this morning when I visited her in her care unit. And here it goes. Therefore, we do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory, far beyond all comparison. Is this hard? Problem solving? All of that stuff? Yeah, it is. But you know what? This will is nothing compared to the glory that is to come. While we look, Paul writes, not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. Put simply, just another 20, 30 more years, in my case. Standing tall, stepping up, being faithful. And then it's the eternal way to glory. Okay, I'm looking forward to that. I'm Greg Kokel here. This is Stand to Reason.
Are you wondering where to get started as an ambassador for Christ? We've put together a fresh approach to help you grow in knowledge, wisdom, and character. Go to str.org, follow the Start Here link under Training. You'll find fun videos, informational resources, and key articles. The more you train, the better you can engage others with confidence, courage, and grace. Don't miss the quiz at the bottom of the page where you can test the skills you've learned as an ambassador for Christ. Simply follow the Get Started link under the training section at the top of the webpage at str.org.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff. Post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
Okay, friends, back at you here. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind and, I guess, a piece of my heart at the same time. Every once in a while, some of that comes through. Let's go to Aaron in Ohio, somewhere in Ohio. Where in Ohio are you, Aaron?
There, I am in Columbus, the capital.
Oh, Columbus, okay. I was, how long ago? It was probably about 5 months ago now. I was in
Mount Vernon.
Yeah, is that like it's northeast of Columbus? I flew into Columbus and then drove for about an hour or so with my client and my host rather. And yeah, Mount Vernon. It's a Christian school.
It is, yeah. And I would have gone to that event, but I heard about it too late.
Oh, okay. Well, good. I'm glad that you called, though. How can I help?
Yeah. Hi. Well, I think I have so many questions. It's hard to pick the right one. Poor Amy, I've emailed her so many. I was at the
Well, you could be a regular caller then with all your different questions. So I have no trouble with that.
We're quite the time difference, so I had to hurry up and get the kids to bed so that I was uninterrupted.
Oh, it's almost 8:30 your time then, right?
It is. Okay. Yes. But I was at the Women in Apologetics conference, and it was nice to be able to put so many faces with names, I was able to meet Amy, so that was great.
Oh, what a treat. I agree. It's a great experience.
Yeah, I've been trying to study apologetics for the last couple years. I've, like so many other people, I've been a believer in church my whole life, but I didn't know what I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And once your kids get to a certain age, you start to realize that you need to have some answers for things. So mm-hmm. I've been doing the best I can and read a lot of your books and listen to so many podcasts. So I'm humbled to be able to talk. Mm-hmm. But I think that this particular question is probably a rather easy one.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I think people probably wonder about it.
Okay.
It seems that the trend is that we only hear about comfortable topics from the pulpit nowadays. And as such, we talk about love so often. And I understand the command to love our enemies and the underlying reasons, but how literally do we love those who want to actually physically harm us?
Mm-hmm.
I know that we hate the evil and we pray forgiveness for the person. But what is the biblical guidance, I suppose?
Well, let me give you
self-defense.
Here's a couple of thoughts. 1 Corinthians 13, since you invoke the issue of love, and this happens a lot on a number of different issues, so we need to put this concept in its right biblical, in its context. 1 Corinthians 13 is the longest passage in the Bible, I think, that talks about love, and it describes God's understanding of love. And one line in there is very important. It said, love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if one is promoting love, And they say, well, out of love, I am being accepting of homosexuality, and we accept all of that in our church and whatever because we're trying to be loving. Well, then you're not being loving in the way that Paul understood godly love, because that is a rejoicing, at least arguably, rejoicing in unrighteousness rather than rejoicing in the truth, okay? I just use that as one example, but there's a lot mm-hmm. of different things like that where people sanitize immoral behavior by calling it loving. And this verse, I think, is really helpful to put that in its right perspective. So let's just take, if someone is doing something, your question is self-defense, okay? If somebody is harming another individual physically, just in general, is that an evil thing?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Okay, pretty straightforward. I know you're thinking, wait, is this a trick question?
No,
no, that's an evil thing. Okay. So do we rejoice in unrighteousness, or we rejoice in the truth? Well, it seems to me that that is unrighteousness to allow that, and it is righteous to stop the evil, okay? If it's righteous to stop the evil and love rejoices in righteousness and truth, then it is loving to stop the evil attack, all right? So it shouldn't make any difference, it seems to me, whether the evil attack is against someone else or against me. In either case, it is an attack on an image bearer, and it should be stopped. And if I stop somebody else from attacking a third party, that's good, that's righteous, that's loving to the third party. And if I stop someone from attacking me, it is also righteous and loving to do so. And what I did is I just described my line of reasoning for that. It says in the Mosaic Law that it's wrong to murder. If it is wrong to murder, then it is right to try to stop murder. Whether I'm stopping the murder of somebody else or trying to stop the murder of me is irrelevant to that moral rule. Regardless, it's still the right thing to do to stop the murder of an image bearer. So if I am acting in self-defense to stop harm that somebody means to do to me, or to stop someone from murdering me, in both cases, I am doing something that is morally sound, that is appropriate, that is an act of love, because I'm rejoicing in righteousness, not in unrighteousness. Do you see the point?
I do. And that's pretty straightforward. What if it results in a perpetrator being killed?
Well, I don't see any difference there. That is, what if we have to resist to protect ourselves with lethal force? And the answer is, if it's a lethal threat, it can be opposed with lethal force. The commandment is not against killing. The commandment is against murder. And there's a difference. We have a different word for both in English, and in Hebrew there's a different word for both as well. Not all killing is wrong. In fact, God commanded killing a number of times in the Old Testament. I lost count. I think there are 12 or 14 different violations or laws that are punishable, that are capital crimes in the Mosaic law, punishable by death. And God clearly sent armies out to kill other people. So God is not a pacifist, and he's not against killing. What he's against is unjust, unrighteous killing. That's what murder is. So the commandment doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not murder. Big difference, okay?
There is.
So if it turns out that that I am being opposed with lethal threat, then I am justified, it seems to me, in responding with lethal force in order to protect my life.
That makes sense.
Makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, some might say that Jesus changed that, and they talk about the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, if he slaps you on the right hand, on the right side, then turn your cheek, basically. But it's
right.
There's a very good reason not to think, a bunch of good reasons not to think that Jesus was saying we should not oppose any evil at all or we shouldn't defend ourselves. And in fact, when Jesus himself was slapped, at least in one occasion at his own trial, he didn't turn the other cheek. He held the person accountable for his action. He said, if I did wrong, bear witness to the wrong, but if I did no wrong, then why did you slap me? Very interesting. Jesus himself. So anyway, you were going to say something else, so Eric.
No, I appreciate it. I can see how straightforward that is. I just think that we don't hear that part of it very often.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people get confused by thinking that they need to turn the other cheek when somebody's harming them or could harm them.
Yeah. Now, most of the time when turn the other cheek, or most of the time when people are being opposed by someone, it is not a lethal threat or an injurious threat.
Right.
It does fall under the category that Jesus had in mind. When you think about somebody, if Jesus said, if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the left also. Now, you think about this for a minute. Are most people right-handed or left-handed?
Right.
Okay, if somebody slaps you with their right hand, on what cheek does the slap land?
The left.
On the left. How does somebody strike you with their right hand on your right cheek? Backhanded.
The back of their hand.
Yes. Now, see, when you think about a backhanded slap, well, that's not meant to injure. That's meant to insult. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what Jesus is getting at. It says when you're insulted, you're not going to return evil for evil, but, you know, rather than doing that, you're willing to suffer another insult, basically. Most of the time, the circumstances that we're faced with people who oppose us, whether they're nasties out in the public or whatever,
right,
or people who don't agree with us, or even people in our own family. Look at marital relationships, when a husband and wife get into a fuss with each other, okay? There's very rarely, given the number of those encounters, which are regular, I mean, it's standard for people who are married to have disagreements, even arguments. Those aren't physical. They're not lethal. There's no physical danger there, but
right,
they hurt emotionally, and what we want to do is lash back. And so, and I've noticed this just in my own impulse. Many times when I'm opposing my own wife, my impulse is to, in some sophisticated way, just return evil for evil.
Right.
Whatever I perceive that's evil being done to me, I'm going to get back in some way. And I can be very, very clever in the way that I do that, you know. But I know inside, oh, that's just evil for evil. So this is what Jesus is saying, don't do. Don't retaliate. He doesn't say don't defend. Maybe here's a distinction that would be helpful, a simpler way of putting it. He doesn't say don't defend. He says don't retaliate. And most of the things that we're assaulted with, we don't really need to defend for our well-being, but we get hurt in our feelings and we want to retaliate. And so then right. we offend in kind. We lash out right. with something else. We return evil for evil. So I think that's the way the ethic...
That's a good point that I think we just don't hear. That was interesting how you talked about the hand, and the back of the hand is more meant as an insult.
Right.
That's a great way to look at it.
And as far, you know, Paul, when he's talking about the government, he says, I think it's Paul, he says that Caesar does not bear the sword for nothing. Now, he's talking about Caesar's instrument of retribution. So there is an appropriate punishment, and it's interesting that he uses the word sword because that is the instrument of capital punishment. He seems to be implying that there's a propriety for the government to exercise capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And in another place in the book of Acts, he said, if I am guilty of a crime that is worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. His complaint wasn't that the government shouldn't kill people who are worthy of it. His complaint was he wasn't worthy of it, which is, I think, a fair defense. Right. But notice that it seems that there is a positive aspect of the government defending its people, or let's say the people defending themselves through the arm of government using the sword, capital punishment. Well, if the people writ large can defend themselves through government, why can't individual people defend themselves when they are being attacked individually? I think they can, by extension. So there's another little piece to the puzzle.
Well, great. That helps a lot. sorry it's such a dark topic. I don't know.
It's all right. I had fun with it.
Good.
Okay, Aaron. Hey, thank you so much. And since you say you have lots of questions, you're welcome to call back anytime, and we'll chat some more, Aaron in Ohio, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
All righty, you're welcome. Well, that's looks like that's all the time we have today, friends. I ran out of callers. You might want to think, by the way, if you haven't been able to get in, sometimes the second hour is a great time to jump in because things get a little lean sometimes, not all the time. But in any event, Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, my dear friends. Bye-bye now.